Welcome to Polycast, a civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mean Team.
Ed Jin.
With guest co-host,
Christy.
But your penalty for showing up late is instant coffee. That'll teach you.
Hello and welcome to episode 236. I'm Christy, and joined by the regular gang, we have the Mean Team.
Hi, hi, hi.
The Gin and Mad.
I have a box of coconuts.
The Quick in Dan.
Wipe out!
And the Coffee in Mackie.
Yes, I'm trying to hit the Coffee in the Mackie right now.
Good times.
Yeah, I just finished one, and I'm like, that wasn't enough.
Not instant.
You make me wish I drank coffee.
I meant the effects of caffeine in coffee, not the coffee itself.
Okay.
Bert has a release date. It is October 9th, apparently, for both Windows and Mac Linux. It's been confirmed that Aspyr is going to ensure a simultaneous release of Sibbert, so that's at least useful. And of course, it's October 9th, which is exactly 6 days after Phyrexicon. So, for all those going to Phyrexicon, there's a good chance you're not getting a beta build that you'll actually see what the actual release build will look like, which is pretty good, because then you'll have 6 days to decide whether or not to cancel your pre-release or pre-order. I know, I'm being mean. But if this Phyrexicon's the same as the last one, then they should have it available to play. So that's cool, especially with the Mac Linux simultaneous release, since we've been having issues with that lately. And, of course, a mention of the vanilla patch was in the thread. And, yes, they will probably release the vanilla patch on the same day as Rising Tide.
Yeah, it's pretty...
pretty consistent for Brexit. Release the vanilla patch either the day before or the day of.
When Civilization Beyond Earth Rising Tide is released, there's this third faction that we now know about that you'll be able to choose from. Or you can just completely ignore all the new factions and play the old ones, I suppose.
That's right. Tichers, and it's led by Lena. It's based on the Rhine. It's the area of the world where the Sponter is from.
Agreements cost 50% less diplomatic capital, and purchasing units and buildings cost 25% less diplomatic capital is the unique ability.
Interesting. So she's, like, straight involved with diplomacy.
Yeah, from what it looks like they're pulling it, they're a sub-faction of the European Union.
You should basically pull the card of, oh, we need to have one or two factions that are basically based around any new mechanic we put in. Right, you're it and you're it. That's how it looks so far with two of the three that have been revealed.
Yeah, she's like the anti-Elodie.
Yeah, that too.
And, of course, the community is very hung up right now on an apparent disproportional representation of the Earth of present day in the Beyond Earth universe.
Of course.
Yeah, this is a surprise.
But I'm going to point out that 90% of the Earth's population lives above the equator. So, yeah.
Wasn't there someone on Reddit who had something like that recently, that basically analyzed the current sponsors and where they kind of cover on the Earth?
Yeah.
And that the original aid actually covered a fair amount of what is the kind of existing major population basis.
But I think you also have to take into account the lore of Beyond Earth and what happened right before. In other words, between the Beyond Earth time and present day, certain things happened that changed the landscape of the planet, which no doubt influenced the origin of some or all of these factions.
Yeah, but kind of one of those things, when they had the first eight factions cover vast majority of the planet, if not all of it, quote-unquote, it's sort of hard to pull out new sponsors. Like, yes, we're going to randomly split Africa in half, because, I don't know. Starts making the lore be a bit of an issue.
But someone's analysis of the lore, at the very least, in African Union kind of had them focus more south and east Africa, leaving West Africa out. They kind of made a bit of sense.
Now, if you expand the desert sufficiently, you could muscle out a lot of the population representation from there. If you're doing something that really screws the world.
a lot of the conversation about where Integer is from and the backstory is because when we find out the unique ability, because it's a new mechanic, or I guess you could argue revised mechanic sort of in a way, that we haven't had a chance to play with yet, it's kind of understandably difficult to say whether this is good or bad, because how useful is diplomatic capital? And if diplomatic capital is not very useful, then it's 50% less for agreement costs or 25% for unit and building costs, and we also still don't know when we're going to be able to purchase units and buildings of diplomatic capital. We just know it's not at the start. So I guess it's kind of hard in the abstract to talk about the unique ability. And so let's just talk about the politics because, well, we can. Eagle Pursuit tweeted Pete Murray, community manager at Firaxis Games, essentially saying, what does Integer stand for? It's in all caps, so it must be an abbreviation, an acronym, something. And the response is, it stands for, and then it's spelled out in German, and I am going to save everyone's ears and not try to pronounce any of that.
Cool.
English translation. Initiative for Sustainable Technologies, Efficiency, Justice, and Righteousness. And I think, woo,
that's a mouthful.
We think highly of ourselves.
Well, we need this long name because we need to get the point across.
Yeah, could be.
Although, quite frankly, my favorite non-sequitur comment that I read was from Veras, which was, after seeing their colors, I officially hate everything about this faction. Whoa. Come on, Sith, come on now.
The only thing I did notice is the whole bonus can be powerful, which is something that the Buzzing is kind of mentioning in the comments, that the bonuses we're seeing of what you can buy with diplomatic capital look strong, because I think I saw this take someone's primary trait in a deal costs like 25 diplomatic capital a turn. You know, getting half off of that as Integer, you're kind of going to be able to get a fair few for your books or for your capital, whatever the hell they call it.
Reveals Integer's unique trait. Level 1 is 50% less diplo capital for agreements costs, and then purchase 25% less for units and buildings. And then level 2, get put up to 60% less capital for agreements, and then 50% less for units and buildings. And level 3 would be 75% less for agreements and 75% less for diplo capital. So somewhere in there, things get really, really cheap, though depends on how easy it is to get all your traits and services up and running. If you already have ones you like at some point, then costing less doesn't really matter as much.
Given the number of factions that are in the game, we like to think that if Faction X doesn't like Faction Y, and Faction Z is trading with Faction Y, Faction X is going to be like, you know what, I don't want to agree with you, you suck.
Well, probably.
Or some other such. According to Supremacy King 2, Integer's two agreements that they can sell to others, party politics, more diplomatic capital from your capital city, and information warfare, war score increased by certain percentage. Oh, there's that war score thing again. From the chat, further, the Buzzing, it doesn't seem to change trait costs, but they also seem to be adjusting trait costs at present. They changed a lot over the last two streams I saw. Yeah, no doubt, probably may have potentially different builds we're seeing. And you didn't see a limit in terms of the number of agreements, but each civ has up to 4, and they seem pretty expensive to take, though we don't know how diplomatic capital generation changes late game. Yeah, that's true. We really don't know that much about how much diplomatic capital changes early game, let alone late game.
Yeah.
Guess we're going to find out. Civilization Online, also coming to Hong Kong, Macau, and China. This came from a earnings report from Take-Two Interactive. Carl Slatoff, the president, mentioned specifically through a publishing partnership with Game First and recently announced a deal to launch the title in China, the world's largest PC online games market, through an online publishing powerhouse, Qiho 360. Not that I pretend to know how to pronounce that properly or even pretend to know that I'd even heard of this place before now. It's like, okay, they're announcing more and more markets. It's consistent with our previous reports on Civilization Online, where 2K Games is partnering with local companies to essentially manage that service, which seems smart to me. They already know the market. They're already established. They've already got the personnel, infrastructure. It just sounds like win, 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 win. Of course, if you're interested in Civilization Online and don't live in any of those places, well, yeah, I guess you root for it doing well in those markets so that maybe it will come to a market closer to you. It is expected, Civilization Online is, to arrive in fiscal 2016, which of course is not super, super specific, but it's probably a little too early to announce a month, let alone a date attached to that. I mean, with Civilization Beyond Earth, it was coming fall 2015, and then essentially a couple of months before release, it's like, oh, it's coming in a couple of months, here's the month, and here's the day. Well, okay, thank you.
Another thing that was mentioned in the fiscal report, which has also been spread across on the Civilization Facebook and everywhere else, is that the Civilization series as a whole has reached 31 million units shipped.
Yay!
As well.
Which is a hell of a lot more than the 21 million it was in April last year. So how did they get 10 million that quickly?
Yes, as compared to the 21 million sold in the previous 20-plus years.
Yeah. Mm.
Mason, wonder how much of that was Civ 5 going 75% off in the various Steam sales?
Oh, yeah, probably.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's how the other 10 million happened with Steam sales.
Like, get the entire Civ 5 collection for 10 euro.
Or something, yeah. Civ 5 Complete, yeah, that would be out there. I did a copy of it. Now, granted, I guess it causes some question of, like, okay, you sold 10 million copies, except you sold it at, like, 90% discount. So you didn't really make up that much.
If we want to get really technical, they talk about shipping 31 million units. They didn't technically say they sold 31 million units.
So you're saying that Steam is sitting on, like, 4 or 5 million keys for Civ 5 that they haven't sold yet?
I'm certain they did sell them. I find it amusing that they use the word ships as opposed to sold.
Before digital distribution, ship used to be that the company pressed this many CDs or whatever and shipped it to stores.
Physically dispatched, yes. The removable media.
So, yeah, the actual shipping to stores versus the actual purchase in the store, those numbers are different. And, of course, they want to talk about stuff they shipped because that's always a higher number.
But of course, back when they only shipped at the stores, it didn't matter as much because they sold the money up front anyway.
Yeah, well, the stores would buy.
Yeah, the stores would buy them and then they'd sell them on. But, of course, 2K would already have the money.
Yep.
Whereas these days, digitally, I presume they don't get the money until the person buys it on Steam.
Yeah, when it's... And whether or not 2K's numbers also include the Aster Linux Mac versions of it.
I doubt it.
I also wonder if, you know, any time that they sold Civ 5 Complete, do they count that as one sale, or do they count it as three by counting Civ 5, Gotham Kings, and Brave New World?
No, it'd be counted as one.
Okay.
I would think so, because it's attached to the title, as opposed to the complement of the title, as it were.
Yeah, and I'm pretty sure they don't count the DLCs for that at all.
Yeah, I wouldn't expect them to count the miniature DLCs, but it made me think about the major expansions.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure those get counted.
That's what I mean. Yeah, if they counted Civ 4 Warlord or Civ 4 Beyond the Sword as a separate purchase.
Probably, because even back in the day, they used to get their own boxes. So
that's the only way you could sell it to them.
Well, that's true. Anyways, 10 million units sold in the last year just shows digital distribution has massively increased Civ's footprint.
Woo.
That's the primary thing to take away from that. Digital distribution is good.
Hey, if it wasn't for Steam selling Civ 4 at 75% off, I never would have bought it.
So I bought it back in the day when it came out, so meh.
David William Wilkin on Facebook said, have every version hashtag one more turn. It's true, including Civilization 5, the base game, but not the expansions. I had it all as physical media. They're on shelves right behind me.
Physical media? Oh, you're so last century.
You ageist.
What effectively has been popping up in the feedback is a question of whether or not people get back to BE based on word of mouth, in effect. One of these comments, us constructively adding details to potential Civvert features, is a useful thing, like the diplomacy thing last time, where we're talking about assigning numerical values to peace offerings and produces a viable solution.
Akin says, always a perfect time to do laundry when a new episode is released.
Sure.
I like that you associate dirty laundry with the show, but okay, you know, that's...
No, he equates cleaning things up with the show.
Oh, okay, so we're the cleaning solution, not the dirty laundry.
Yeah.
Okay.
So regarding the discussion of AI resource trades, i.e. when we were talking about how abusive it was, he agrees with you regarding strategics, but when it comes to luxuries in Civ 5, it is good to be allowed to trade gold for it. Maybe. I kind of disagree. But it allows to then buy a luxury for gold, increasing the liquidity of resource exchanges rather than relying on one-one bartering. Possible, but if you want to do that sort of thing, I'd almost say the implementation of maybe a slightly later game, or actually even early game, because this sort of thing happened, bizarre type thing, where you go, well, I have X free resources and you have Y free resources, and that person has an extra one, so I will trade you this one, and you will pay to have that person give me theirs, or something along the line. That way, the intermediary steps might disappear, or something along that line. Of course, you started talking about, yes, AI shouldn't want a luxury at full price when it has plus 30 happiness. Yeah. Unless, of course, it's going for mass gold mages. And then it does want more extra happiness.
So basically Persia, yep. Where they built Chichen Itza.
Yeah. But otherwise, if it's just trying to maintain its happiness, yeah, it doesn't need... But he says that's more of an AI problem than a mechanic problem. Something about devaluing luxuries when it doesn't want them based on its happiness is a very easy thing to code. And then he starts tossing stuff out there about being amateur. It's harder for strategics because there's not only happiness considered, but even then it could be improved to consider something else other than just the number of cities AI has, etc.
And Westfall also, in a later post, brought up something, and I think we've talked about it, but he did say, we need, if we could get your thoughts on it, quote-unquote, which is, how are AI opponents going to handle things like players who pose an existential threat to their empire? For example, let's say Ronaldo really respects big armies. What happens when you build your big army and he builds his and the two of you become best buds? How will the other factions react? Instead of two major military factions being rivals who balance each other out, you instead have them on good terms while potentially steamrolling everyone else.
Yep.
Well, I guess it kind of, maybe it comes down to that, hey, let's steamroll everybody. Okay, I'm going to go steamroll Civilization X. No, I am.
Yeah.
No, me.
Well, yeah, at some point, two big militaries will both want the same things, and then some questions will start happening, I'm sure, between the two. But, yeah, like, reality-wise is the smaller AIs in the neighborhood should be ganging together in defense of themselves against the big nasties. So while they might not be able to equal the military, they should be at least all stop trading with them, all stop buying their services or selling services to them, all ally up so that they're all part of the same war, etc.
Two major military factions. I mean, this is to balance each other out. I mean, it is possible that, okay, you're a military threat and I'm a military threat, so there's one measure of why we are having positive relations, but maybe there's certain some things like, hey, you don't follow our particular virtues. What's up with that? Or, you know, you settle too close to us. Or, hey, what are you doing to the aliens? We don't agree on that. You know, I guess it's kind of a question of, you're happy about the size of their army and they're happy with the size of your army. That's one positive modifier. How strong is that modifier, and how strong is that relative to all of the negatives? Because surely there are going to be negatives, at least if nothing over time. If for nothing other than, hey, remember how we used to be over here and you used to be over there? Well, we've been conquering, and we've been conquering towards each other, so here we are.
Yeah, I mean, it really depends, because if you have a huge military, they have a huge military, then they're not going to fear your military, because they also have a huge military. Others will. So there won't be any fear factor on that, which means in the new style, they have to respect you for other things, and they won't respect you necessarily for your military. Well, they might. That'd just be a little bit. So there could be other reasons. And the buzzing in the chat, to summarize it, is part of the problem is making an AI effective is not always the same as making them fun for players to engage with, which is basically true. Just look how much trade doesn't happen in games with all humans being competitive, which is also true. So the choice balance between making AIs believably functional versus making them irrational sociopaths, which is basically what a player is.
No, I disagree. The player's choices are the most effective ones, and therefore they're not really irrational. The problem is the setup of the game itself. If there were ample incentive to trade, you would see trading in competitive multiplayer.
Yeah.
I don't think making the AI play badly on purpose is a good cover-up for a bad model of an in-game mechanic, which is essentially what Sif has done all along.
Mm. Yeah, there should be reasons. I guess we'll see if people actually play multiplayer in a competitive setting. Do they buy services from each other? Do they cancel services? Do they actually use that set of mechanics? Or is it that they only boost up their own traits and then they screw everybody else on the services? We'll have to find out.
Episode 230 with Dan Q, Makalua, the Mian Team, Majin, and Carl 5872. Not one but two articles started by a returning guest co-host on more than one occasion, a Mega Bears fan, Jason Grade, and it is a Civilization V retrospective where on the 3rd of June he started with the top 10 good ideas that Civilization V brought to the Civ series. And then the next day, of course, we had to have the top five bad ideas. Anyway, so both articles were posted before starting a thread on CFC a few days after that, on the 8th of June, where as of this recording, it has more than 2,000 views and 60 replies. So let's start with the good, not only because he started with the good, but because that's not going to take very long to go through, probably, because who has a lot to say about things that are nice? Let's talk about things that make us go, grarg!
Grarg.
Number 10, customizable religion. Number 9, the Pact of Secrecy, which was removed, sad face, and preparing for war. The tactical one unit per turn hex-based combat at number 8. Cumulative cultural progress, social policies. Strategic resource supply. Archaeology, great works, and tourism at number 5. Then natural wonders, city-states takes the bronze. Notification-based user face takes the silver. And the gold of good ideas, according to Mega Bears fan, is the civilization unique traits, units, buildings, improvements, etc.
Pact of Secrecy?
Yeah, vanilla. They had to get rid of it. Or didn't have to, but they chose to.
I just think that's an interesting thing to put on the top 10, because the other stuff, I agree, is great.
Wouldn't top 10 bad ideas for him then be removal of the Pact? You removed it.
Why did you remove it? This is fun. And we still make jokes about it.
Well, someone actually questioned, why did you put Pact of Secrecy on the list? Because part of the reason it was taken out was because of how really useless it ended up being. Beetle then said, perhaps this is more about a feature that is great in theory, and mostly they work, but still not feel quite finished. Mega Bears fan said that I liked that the Pact of Secrecy was an affirmative action that two players could take against a third player without necessarily declaring war. It was an agreement that both parties would do what they could to disrupt the third player and would supposedly have each other's back if one of the other provoked conflict. Yeah, this have each other's back and supposedly and how this was defined. And what effect did it really have in the game other than
nothing.
To say, here's a reason to use the diplomacy feature. But what does it do in game? It gives you an opportunity to interact with leaders. But what does it do in the game? It gives you an opportunity to interact. Yeah, okay, we went through that already.
It lets you gossip.
Yep. I mean, with respect to the AIs, it also could point them in a direction that, like, if they're trying to just decide who to go after in a war, they could go, well, that person also doesn't like them, so maybe we go that way instead and we can, you know, get some friends. His points of it could have been expanded with better diplomacy stuff like the UN features and espionage. Yes, it could have been expanded, and like the whole boot for diplomacy could have been burned to the ground and thrown out and replaced with something better. Unfortunately, it wasn't.
I don't have much else to say myself on the top 10 good ideas list, other than Polycast itself is mentioned in actually both articles. In the good ideas article, we are mentioned in the number 1 point, as stated in Polycast episode 223, and I'm certain that the fact that Mega Bears fan was on that episode played no part in his mentioning it at all.
Or the fact that it was mentioned played no part in why you chose to talk about it.
Absolutely not. The inclusion of completely unique abilities for every civilization helps you integrate the education historical context into the actual gameplay. You don't just read about what made the civilizations unique and significant on the world stage. You get to play those unique abilities. Now, you can also, as an aside, I'm no longer quoting him, you can question, was that perhaps maybe the best unique to choose historically? Was that implemented as well as it could be? But I would say that's a fair summary of what came out of episode 223 on this topic.
Well, I mean, the whole point of uniques is when you actually have a civ that's been around for a long time, it has managed to hit a variety of different versions of itself, which means that the developers have to pick an era, basically, and go with it, or try and pick and choose across lots of eras like they did with Germany, and then make it a little schizophrenic.
No matter what, though, like, Civ 5 is definitely the best of the Civs at this aspect, and they have more different unique things, but it's the first time where you really feel a heavy change in gameplay with some of the uniques, or, like, you completely alter your plans if you get certain civilizations versus others. And I guess Civ 4 had Praetorians, and it had Redcoats, which got nerfed down or something, but it didn't alter your gameplay much, and there'd be games where you would never use those things. Whereas in Civ 5, you get something like Venice, and you could just feel it.
Oh, yeah, because the uniques extended beyond a unique unit and a unique ability. It would be, hey, here's a unique terrain improvement.
Ooh.
Yeah. So you get to the point where you're actually playing these Civs differently in a given start than you would play other Civs much more often than any previous Civ iteration. And that extra consideration, it did really bring a lot to it. So I agree with that at number one.
And to go back briefly on the Pact of Secrecy, and then it was mentioned earlier about tying that into espionage. Pact of Secrecy and espionage never met in the Civ series, because by the time the espionage was introduced, the Pact of Secrecy was gone. So perhaps maybe in a Civilization VI, if there ever is such a thing, maybe those two things can be revisited and be revisited together, just like you would revisit anything in a Civilization series, the good and the bad, and whether or not even the good in one Civilization title makes sense in the next one, for instance. And then, of course, that takes us to the bad. Ooh, and Urns.
Why is number 10 not number 1, dang it?
Would number 10 be there, Mackie?
You can't raise capitals. Sometimes I want to raise them. Because this also applies technically to the city-states, since they're considered capitals, mm-hmm. I think.
That's correct.
Yep, yes. They are.
I want to raise capitals. There are city-states in my way.
Oh, well, see, what you do there is you convince Austria to buy the city-state, and then you burn it down.
But imagine, what do you do if Austria's not in your game?
Hacks.
Yeah.
Hacks.
Hacks. Yeah, that's the solution to everything.
Hacks. And on this list, number 9 being insta-heal, if we're talking about the full extent of Civilization V, because in 3 months, it'll be 5 years since the game was released. Wow, we are so old. But yeah, initially, insta-heal was, in fact, just that, insta-heal. Initially, remember we had hit points, it was only out of 10. Oh, you're down to 1 out of 10 hit points, or you're down to 4 out of 10 hit points. Press insta-heal button, and boom, it is insta-heal. It is not as what the as it used to be, and I actually don't mind it. I don't think I would put it on the top 10 bad ideas for Civilization V now, in part because if you do use the insta-heal, and this was always the case, you are giving up a longer-term benefit of a promotion that would carry over in future turns that you could then build, especially in earlier units. You can upgrade them. Oh, they carry that promotion upon upgrade to a higher unit, so that unit is now potentially better than one that would just roll right off the line. So I wouldn't put that anymore on the top 10 bad ideas.
Especially because if they decoupled it from the act of taking a promotion, which in Civ 4 would heal half of your total current damage instantly. And so, like, if you fought a unit with your unit and it didn't die and you had experience available for a promotion, you could take one or two promotions and get well over half your health back if you took two promotions.
Yeah, well.
And you thought the promotions, you weren't making a trade there.
Yep. Insta-heal on its own, yeah, it's decoupled, and yeah, you can do it, but I don't like it, really. The concept in for this type of game, magic healing.
Short-term versus long-term.
Through long-term. All you have to
and
do
magic
is fight,
healing,
like, make
a
new...
turn is every year in every instance, except for maybe late game on slower speeds, and often it's way more than 1 year. You can do a lot in a year.
Yeah, I had definitely stronger visceral against insta-heal when it was that. Boop. Right up back to full strength.
Yeah.
Sorry, what?
Yeah, since it's nerf, it's not as horrible.
And frankly, you can just spam out other units. You don't need highly promoted units. They aren't a requirement for doing good things. You just spam more. Oh, lost that one? Oh, well. I'll make a new one. And by the way, it comes with 2 promotions. Oh, yeah, I could just choose not to use those and kill things. Or if you don't have promotion push-off enabled, you just build something new that has multiple promotions. Already, and then it can start insta-healing from there.
Comes with 2 health packs.
Yay!
Oh, there you go, the insta-heal, that's just simulating a supply route in the sense of carrying medics, having like a medics behind the scene, helping you on that turn roll over to improve some of your health. Look at that.
Portable hospital.
I kind of agree that it was a bad idea, the way it was implemented anyways.
But more so at first.
Yeah, more so at first.
Still bad, I just wouldn't put it at top 10 now, since we're publishing this in 2015.
Although I wouldn't put can't raise capitals in top 10.
Not unless you change the way that victory worked.
Yeah, that too.
Now, number 8. The summary, I don't think, did justice as much as I'm going to read directly from the article, because it's more specific. Unit upgrades, the Lonely Chariot, and the Schizophrenic Lancer. Yeah, this upgrade path of, I'm sorry, this upgrades into what? And, okay, can I upgrade into anymore? What do you mean I can't upgrade this anymore? Huh? What happened here? I'm not sure I'd put it in the top 10, though, but...
It is annoying.
It's still bad.
But, yeah.
It's annoying.
Yeah. Unit upgrades. The upgrade pass, especially for a couple of them, definitely bad. Definitely. And it's really not the Lancer that has the problem. It's the stuff before and after the Lancer that's the problem.
Yes, in the middle of this path, we're just going to throw the Lancer, and you kind of sit there and look at it and go, okay.
That's nice. Because Pike to Lancer is not really a bad thing. Because the Pike is a melee unit. It has pointy sticks. All you did was give them horses. So that's not a horrible thing. after that, though...
But then suddenly there's a helicopter.
No, no, there was a pit stop as an anti-tank gun.
Yes, but still, my horses became helicopters. What?
No, I'm fine with the horse becoming helicopters because it's a mobile unit, and that's what happened to actual combat units, is that they eventually upgraded, and the more mobile ones got helicopters.
I understand the reasoning, it's a little anti-tank gun.
Yeah. No, the pit stop at the anti-tank gun is the real problem for the Lancer.
I know what they're going for.
What is this crap?
And cavalry upgrades into tanks, so...
Yeah.
And this is not a saving grace, but the fact that it happens in the later game, as opposed to the earlier game, when you consider the scope of, you know, your standard civilization game, air quotes standard, no late starts, people.
And also keep in mind that that whole side of the tech tree tends to be ignored completely in most games. The other part of it is the promotion's lack of adjustments from one to another, which is where the Chariot Archer comes in, where you get ranged-based promotions, but it upgrades to a melee unit, and now you have all these ranged-based promotions that are completely useless. Thank you.
Yeah, that is the biggest issue under this umbrella, I think. That is completely disconnected. It's like a smaller-scale version of what used to happen with social policies. Oh, I'm sorry, do you want to open rationalism? Oh, do you have piety there? Okay, you can do that, but everything you did before that? Yeah, it's gone.
I really do hate the fact that through the line of a lot of what is written, starts talking about the rich getting richer. Yeah, guess what? 4X. Exploit, expand, explore, exterminate. The rich do get richer. That is the point of a 4X game.
I think there's two ways you can approach that, because having a game where the outcome is decided, but you still have to go through the motions for a long time does suck. So you either have a mechanic whereby once you're in a position that no one can realistically challenge you, it's not going to be very long before you win. And I think that's the route you go with 4X. Like, so 4's domination victory, for example. Contrast with Conquest, where you had to wipe everyone out. If you had over, like, 60% of the world's land in pop, you won. They're like, yeah, here, you won the game.
Yeah.
That's helpful, because then you don't have to go through the motions so much. And then the alternative is some sort of rubber banding mechanic to keep everyone close. But we're not playing Mario Kart, so I don't think we need one.
True. Now, I agree with you there, Phil. I think there are times where, well, okay, this person is a runaway, and the game, it's a foregone conclusion. And if you look back at the history, it's like, well, they did everything right, and everyone else?
Did not.
Not so much. I think that's the exception in practicality, because often the runaway is, well, how'd your luck skill get so good? Man, how did that happen? Then that makes you think, if I can go back to a previous save, could I do something differently? Or is it going to substantially be, no, I can go back and I can do this and I can do that, but it's one step forward, two steps back. Is there going to be a foregone conclusion? I'm screwed. I might as well just restart the game. That is crap.
Yeah, no, see, because he also brings it back up to the constant snowballing. And no, I think it's crap if you play a game and the AI gets bigger and better than you and you choose not to. Guess what? Drop a difficulty level, learn to play.
Although because I would you like let it happen. A better dogpiling mechanic more consistently.
Yeah.
If there is one true runaway, the other player should be trying to win. That includes the player and the AI should be trying to stop the runaway from just crushing them and winning the game easily.
Oh, maybe there's a way to use the Pact of Secrecy there.
I haven't seen a good AI dogpile mechanic in many years. The Warlord series did it before it became more RTS, back when it was turn-based, had a really good one. When you got past a certain point, literally everyone would come for you. And that was true for the AI as well.
Number 7, excessive warmonger hate, which I'm glad Mega Bears fan points out. This would have been number 2 or 3 on the list if the fall 2013 patch for Brave New World hadn't taken decent steps to address it. It's still a problem, but nowhere near so bad as it was earlier in the game's existence. So just to summarize, I just quoting briefly from his write-up, capturing just one or two cities in the ancient or classical era could result in every civ in the game labeling you as a warmonger for the remainder of the game and refusing to trade with you, even if you haven't fought a single battle. Yep, that was over the top. So some people might say, well, if you're going domination, of course people are going to hate you, except sometimes you weren't planning on going domination.
The worst part of it is you were just trying to build your 3-city tiny empire. And then an AI that had 5 cities decided to declare war on you, and you said, well, no, screw you, I'm going to take you out. And all of a sudden, you're the bad guy.
Yeah, this kind of snowball like that, really, to end a war, sometimes you do have to take one of their cities, and then someone else hates you, then they'll declare war on you, and then you have to take one of their cities, and it just keeps spiraling, even if you wanted to just be peaceful and get a science victory or a culture victory, and it kind of sometimes forces you down the war path. Or at least that's how I justify all the cities I've raised.
Yeah.
And in the history of this show, how long were we reminding our listeners, hey, if you find yourself in this situation where especially you've been declared on and you're taking cities, don't take out the last city?
Yeah, never take the last one.
It's like on a scale like they're at a 6. 6 out of 10, where 10 is the worst. You're the worst person ever. You're already a 6. And then you take out the capital, and it's like now you're 11. What?
Yes, because that last city was far more important than the 10 other cities you've already taken.
Yep, didn't matter if the last city you took was their original capital or it was the city they settled in the tundra or the ice. That was size 1 or 2. Nope, didn't matter. You're a horrible, horrible person. Sorry for defending myself. Gosh.
And sometimes it's even the civs that ask you to declare war on someone.
Yeah.
They say, like, hey,
can you defend me?
Yeah, defend me. Wait, you took that guy's capital. Well, I don't like you now.
Yeah, but I wanted that. Everybody hates you for warmongering. They don't really hate each other so much for the same thing.
Now, number 6 on Mega Bear's fan list, removing cinematics and other bells and whistles.
Yeah.
Oh, to me, this is too high on this bad list.
It's part of the badness because it made flavor and atmosphere disappear a bit more.
Yes, on the top 10, I think 6 is a little high, at least when you compare to other things that are on the list. But okay, I mean, he does say at one point, I would take Civ 4's cartoonish but immersive and informative graphics over Civ 5 satellite photographics any day. But there's no reason why there couldn't have been a compromise between the two. Yeah, for me, there's some middle ground between what we had in Civilization 4 and Civilization 5 when I also think of questions of all that time and resource and effort you put into cinematics when you have limited resources. Could that have been put better into something else? Like, I don't know, gameplay? Whereas Civilization V seemed to be a little bit too reactive, perhaps, to the criticism of, how about we do some more with the gameplay and forget all of these, you know, like, for example, the Wonder movies. How often do the Wonder movies come up? And they're great. You know, you watch them one or twice, and then you disable them while you continue to play the game for 2, 3, 4, 5 years after the fact.
Yeah, but it's
But my
sad.
Immersion!
But it's sad not to have it. And especially the victory, like, when you actually win. Oh, here's a little blast.
Yeah, having a little bit more of a victory would be nice, but
like, yay, you won, clap, clap.
And then number 5, the linear rigid tech tree. Okay.
I agree.
Yeah.
Bad.
Now, there was one person, and I just happened to catch this, Ikeel, who said he loved both the Mega Bears fans articles, and he agreed with most of the points. He added a little commentary for each, and Mega Bears fan responded to some of it. But on the top 10 bad ideas, in response to the linear tech tree, he wrote, well, this is kind of unavoidable. I think he meant unavoidable, and I'm thinking, actually, no, it's not unavoidable. Are you kidding? I wouldn't say it's as quote-unquote bad as in Civ 4, where you get as extreme bottlenecks, but still, it's kind of, okay, I'm this particular Civ, I'm going to go this, this, that, and that, and everything else being equal, I'm going to go this way and that way through the technology tree, and it's just kind of, I want to get to this particular tech. Do I really need this first? Yep, the path says I do. So I like the tech web from Civilization Beyond Earth. Even at release, and even before the game was released, we were saying, all right, Civilization Beyond Earth has an advantage over Civ 5 because of this, and we hadn't even played it yet. Number 4, and I think you touched on this a little earlier, imagine, constant snowballing.
Really?
Polycast is actually also mentioned. This is where our mention on this list comes. Even though it was neutered a bit, the underlying principle of snowballing is still firmly in place, such as I don't think an episode of Polycast has been aired in the past few years in which the term wasn't spoken.
Well...
I don't know every episode, but definitely a standard and recurring theme, for sure. Even if we didn't use the word snowballing, we were often talking about it anyway.
It's just something with turn-based strategy games.
With this particular complaint coming up, it does show that if you push the game towards quote-unquote tall enough, that people's expectations change.
Yeah.
And I don't understand the appeal for a lot of strategy games going this route, making tall so viable and wide less to the point where you can't play optimally going wide at all in most cases. But that's happening, and because of that, if you want to be a tall player, then you very much don't want to see someone snowball. And so you get these complaints a fair amount.
But then there's also snowballing of going super tall, too.
Yeah. Just saying, there's a systemic reason that's showing up as a complaint.
Tall civilizations where going wide and expanding, you know, one of those 4Xs, got so nerfed into the ground as to be remove one of those Xs out of the 4X. That was the worst thing to happen a civilization in Civ 5.
I know they're going for balance, but they didn't get it.
That is not called balance. That is called skewing the game.
That is called we nerfed it, because I think some people exploited it.
No, it's not an exploit, because you have to expand. No, the problem is they chose a different path for the game, and they thought, hey, you know what, four cities growing tall, that should be called an empire. No, it's not. It's called a freaking city-state, because you know what, I've made city-states bigger than that in-game. Now people think that there's such things as tall civilizations. And you know what? Florence, it was tall. It was not big. It did not win the tech victory. It was a freaking city-state. And then it got ran over by something that actually was big.
No, you look at Venice or the other notable smaller nations. It's
They did stuff, and that's great.
Similar story.
Well, that's the thing. They did stuff in history, and that's great. But guess who didn't win? Them.
Technically, no one's won.
Yeah, but they also don't exist anymore because somebody bigger came along and said, that's cute. Thanks for building that.
Squish.
Yeah. So that was the worst thing. I am all about making tall cities be the core engine of an economy. And if you have a very tall city, it should produce a lot more than like a bunch of crappy cities that have the same population. It should always produce more.
We don't want to go back to Civ 2 days or something. Or everywhere is a city.
Small city. Yeah, you don't want that. But I also don't want to see the game mechanics turn into, you've settled five cities. Screw you.
Number three, forcing small-scale tactical combat onto a large-scale map. And to put this in context, you're Mega Bears fan. On one hand, you're moving individual units around a battlefield, moving formations, performing flanking maneuvers, conducting bombardment, and so on. On the other hand, you're also building and growing cities across a continent. And both of these are on the same map. So a single catapult takes up the same area as a city, and armies fill the entire land area of whole nations. Instead of obstacles like buildings, trees, or streams getting in the way of your formation and maneuvers and tactical decisions, entire cities, whole forests, and oceans are battlefield obstacles that your units have to navigate. Sieges of a single city can often spill over into neighboring cities, and naval blockades fill entire seas. I understand that the scale is supposed to be abstracted, but this is really pushing the boundaries.
Mm.
I guess at this point, 5 years later, maybe I complained more about it 5 years ago, but now I've adapted. So I don't really feel strongly towards this.
I kind of like it.
You get used to it, but I think it could be done better.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I think Civ 5 in that regard is a step towards one unit per tile being a good model. Picture a scenario where the game is necessarily built 64-bit, and instead of three hexes between cities, you have 10 or more or something on that kind of scale. And because you have the machine resources, it can handle that. Well, now you have a lot more room to maneuver, a lot more terrain you can play with, can generate the map differently.
Mm-hmm.
You have an entirely different experience with a similar idea. It's not that the one unit per tile tactical combat can't work. It got congested because of the limitations of the design and the engine.
I will say it's not quite as bad if you play a huge map. I know not all people like huge maps or even have
that.
Computers that can handle them. Matter. But I mean, and it's still not ideal, but I actually have fun with it.
Yeah, and again, there too, like games designed around accommodating that will run better in the future. But right now, it takes longer in many cases to roll over a turn than play one still, especially if you pick a huge map, and that's just rough.
It's part of the concept of how big is a hex. If it goes 64-bit and all of a sudden each hex is actually taking up less comparative real estate and things get spread out a lot more, then people will probably complain a lot less about hexes because you'd have more space to do stuff.
Number two, no support for mods and multiplayer. The first sentence, this is a great way to shorten a game's lifespan. This was a list, for example, for Civilization 4, say, I don't know, 2010, for example. Well, we wouldn't put this item on the list, and it wouldn't be as a particular issue because multiplayer now is not just, oh, well, this isn't a multiplayer game, it's a strategy game, so it's not that big a deal. You know, it's not intended to be multiplayer. It's not multiplayer only, except that this is 2015, we've got more and more people playing, you've got improved internet connections, and you've got more competition because you've got access to more and more games. It's not like the 90s where it's, okay, I go into my game store and there's these big publishers with lots of money and here are your set titles and you go for it. What's going to keep people engaged coming back again and again and again? And even if the AI was the best, and I don't think anyone could well ever be able to agree, any two people will necessarily be able to agree that the AI is perfect, because everyone has different ideas of what better versus worse AI is. At some point, I'm looking for another challenge. And multiplayer, even if it works well, and hey, we've said before on this show, Civ 5 multiplayer has come a long way. Absolutely no question. But when you look at all of the mods that are available for Civilization 5 and single player, and then you realize you can't bring that over to multiplayer, that is just like a full stop roadblock that makes you shake your head.
Yeah, I mean, he's half complaining about multiplayer not being good, as well as the lack of mods for it. Yeah. I mean, it is a bit of a fail, and it will technically shorten the game's lifespan, usually, if you don't have a good multiplayer, and if you have less of a good support for mods across the whole game, including multiplayer, then yeah, it does become problems.
But then again, if you look at the stats, of the number of players who play multiplayer, and of the number of people who use mods, how many of those cross-connect, which is probably going to be an even tinier number, so...
Well, that's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Well, it is, yes. Actually. It is a rather self-fulfilling prophecy.
If it worked in multiplayer, then that Venn diagram would have a lot bigger crossover.
Yeah, probably. Or you'd have more people actually playing multiplayer.
Mm-hmm.
And number one on Mega Bear's fan list, focus on a quote-unquote strategy board game rather than Empire Management Sim.
Civilization is never a sim.
Oh, no.
Ever been a sim.
Wow.
Stop saying that in relation
to sim. There's some weight in this one.
Oh.
This goes off the rails. Sorry, Mega Bears fan. You're projecting a little too much.
Although I am going to point out, I will, for fairness, point out that previous Civs have not exactly been purely strategy board games. Purely in that definition of what a strategy board game is. But none of them have ever been a simulation, especially Empire Management Simulation. That is a completely and utterly different thing. If you would like to see a simulation, please go play EU4.
That's not a simulation either, although it's trying to be now.
I would point out that taking the words from Mega Bear fan, it really was akin to a complicated version of Risk or Axis and Allies, the very first Civilization.
And then they did too many things to it.
Well, they added stuff, and it made it better. But not connecting Civilization, the game, to a strategy board game would be bad, because that's really where it came from. That is the entire point of strategy games.
Although, if you got into the micromanagement aspect of Civ 4, you could be fooled at certain points. And that's one of the reasons, the primary reason, that I did not win duty consistently on Civ 4. Sheer emphasis and necessity of micromanaging each tile and planning it. Sometimes 30-plus turns in advance. At that point, you do start to lose the strategy board game feel a little bit.
Yeah.
And it does start looking like an Empire Management sim, but at least to me, that was not a good thing. Some people enjoy that. Some people do. And the best players in Civ 4 are incredible. I'm not going to take it away from them, but man, I did not enjoy that aspect of the game.
Besides, I'm going to point out, Ed Beach is a strategy board game maker. He has strategy board games. He's made them. And then he was put in charge. What do you think was going to happen?
Yes, for the Gods and Kings and Brave New World expansion packs for Civ 5.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Otherwise, what he's really trying to talk about, now that we've gotten past the knee-jerk reaction to the word sim, what he's really talking about is that many, many mechanics have been simplified or abstracted or made to feel not what they were before. And that is a complete and true statement. So much crap was simplified. And he mentions the happiness system, that it was abstracted out to global. And by doing that, they basically screwed themselves out of being able to do more nuanced stuff like, this city is a beacon of happiness. Why don't people migrate there? Because people like that city versus this place sucks. Let's get out of here. So they wiped themselves out on that by going purely global.
Why not just have something else constrain your city growth? Because initially happiness in Civ 5 functioned like Civ 4 maintenance. Why? Why not just decouple those two things from each other and constrain them as you see fit for the engine or how you want the game's design to go or whatever, but it just seemed nonsensical to me from the start.
And yeah, cities not feeling like cities, more like a bot that you drop and take stuff, kind of.
Thanks to Mega Bears fan for these retrospective articles, getting us to think and reflect and raise perhaps some points that we haven't talked about on this show in a while. And again, to remind us just how old all of us are. Oof.
Just you.
We still have some good years in us. No worries.
But yeah, I mean, anytime you come up with a top 10, there will always be arguments over, is that really?
No, there won't be.
Or is there something else that should be a top 10?
Or there will always be a Dan posting his top 10s. Oh my gosh.
Somebody said top 10. Let's talk about it.
Exactly.
This was actually prompted by my reading the article about the 31 million units shipped of Civilization. That news item got me thinking about, especially as Magic was mentioning, the very powerhouse that is digital distribution, decided, I wonder how Civilization V, not just Civilization Beyond Earth, but how has Civilization V been performing as a top seller on Steam? And in fact, on August 9th to 15th, Civilization V was 10th. It returned to the title. And so then I used Google News Search to go back through the reports on MCV UK to find these other articles. And just as an aside, I guess I was sending a lot of traffic to Google that was abnormal because I had to keep proving that I was a human and not a bot.
Bad dad. Not done.
And what it ended up being is that over the past 52 weeks, over the past year, Civilization V was a top seller for 7 weeks, and Beyond Earth for 9. Now, I didn't go super, super detailed and then try to figure out, okay, was there like that 75% off weekend timing to that, which no doubt the sales help drive lots of things, but I just found it interesting, not so much about Beyond Earth, because Beyond Earth hasn't been out that long, but the Civilization V keeps popping up, which I think goes to towards how is it possible that Civilization V, or just the Civilization series in general, has managed to get 10 million units shipped in the last year when it took 20-plus years to get to 21 million. I think that just goes to show the strength behind these numbers. We don't see on these rankings, okay, you are first because you shipped X number of units, and you shipped X number of units, so you're second. But it just gives you kind of a relative feel, and I was surprised how often Civ was appearing on the top 10. I mean, you know, Civ titles still are going to be selling, and we know that Civilization V is also, from an article we looked at earlier in the year, a very popular game, you know, relatively speaking, to other games on Steam for play, and how often that appears on the list in terms of concurrent users playing. An interesting look, and perhaps in support of anyone that might say, are they really certain they got that 10 million unit number right over the past year? Anecdotally, anyway, this supports this. Civilization V was 7th from July 26th to August 1st on Steam sales, and they were 10th from August 9th to 15th.
Yeah, both dates, from what I could see, had a 75% off discount during it, so it still surprised me how many people haven't actually bought it yet, and that it's still able to get up so high on the sales charts.
Steam still has Civ V as the 7th most played game right now, 48,000 people.
And yes, disclaimer, the playing could mean you loaded the game and you walked away and you went to work for 12 hours. Mm-hmm. We know. Mm-hmm. Now, it is true that most of the Civ title rankings on Steam, whether it's Civilization V or Civilization Beyond Earth, were between 6th to 10th. 5 topped out at 6th, August 24th to 30th of last year, and Civilization Beyond Earth was 2nd from November 23rd to 29th. Although, I think we can understand the timing of some of these rankings, I don't know.
Yeah.
Is there a Civ title that was released about that time?
I wonder why.
So PC Gamer decided to rank the best and worst of the Civilization series. The best Civ game, that was actually Civ 5, surprise, surprise. 62.9% that was Civ 5, so that's a big. The very distant number 2 is Civ 4. Everything else is less than what Civ 4 had total. And then, interestingly, you go to the worst Civ, and I was looking at this for a minute, and I was kind of confused, and I realized, oh, wait, they put Beyond Earth in here. It's like, ow, wow. And there was an equal amount of people, almost, that said the original Civ was bad that also said that Civ 3 was bad. And it was like, guys, really? The original Civ?
A few general takeaways from that. First off, when we say best and worst, I wish it had said a ranking of favorite and least favorite.
Yeah.
Because that also ties into timing as well, like people saying like the original Civilization was the worst. Try to rank the first Civilization today as compared to when it was released. Your expectations are understandably very different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I would like to have seen this poll without Beyond Earth in it, just to see how the main series stacked up, because I think that really skewed the worst.
I'm just going to throw this out here, because it's based on exactly 1,049 responses. Probably the high majority of players have not even played Civ 3 or earlier.
Oh, that was going to be my third general point.
Yeah.
How do we know?
Yeah, I don't think they've actually played any of them. So all we know is that there's a lot of people who played Civ 5. There's still some holdovers from Civ 4, but that's about it. That's all we really know. And I would also like to point out that having two separate polls saying what's the best and what's the worst is statistically goofy, because if you look at the numbers, there are some people who say that Civ BE was the best, and it's actually higher than Civ, the base game, which means that when you go and look at what's the worst, all of a sudden the numbers are different. So if you go based on the best, then technically the worst is the base Civ, because BE would be slightly higher than it.
And I think it's unfair to include Civilization Beyond Earth on this, because it is not officially a completed title yet.
Yeah, there's that too.
But the one thing you should notice in the article is that while it wasn't actually put out in a chart, it did mention the case of the number of people who said which particular Civ was their first. And it's quite an even spread throughout all the games. 18% who said Civ 1 and Civ 2 were their first, 22% for Civ 3, 17% for Civ 4, and 22% for Civ 5.
If you have games that are that old, it's hard for them to hold up mechanically to the newer games. So it's not surprising that stuff from, like, pre-2005 is struggling, and stuff from pre-2000, it's ridiculous. Some of these games are older than, like, Doom, or right in that territory.
Or older than the people responding to the poll.
Potentially,
yeah, it's true.
Yeah, given actually what we've already said, it makes me think of a few comments that I pulled out in response to this PC Gamer article. Volch to Sass said, Civ 1 is the worst Civ? BS much? Some people just don't remember merits of grandfathers. Sad.
Mm-hmm.
I am well aware this article is claiming that Civ 5 only became popular post-expansions. However, it provides no source of this beyond anecdotal evidence. This is especially problematic when you see the author later crow triumphantly that Civ 5 is suddenly the popular choice. It is my supposition that it is just as likely that Civ 5 has always been this popular, while Civ 4 supporters like myself have always been a small but vocal minority. I don't have proof of that either, but then I didn't write an article implying otherwise, from David Schallert. And I just think this is history repeating itself for both the best and the worst.
Yep.
But let's go a year after Civilization V was released, so say 2011. Pretty sure Civ V would have been the worst because of problems real or perceived. And also, when you think about those that might not even have had disliked Civilization V vanilla upon release, because maybe they didn't play multiplayer as a major example, but then once additional expansions come out, you then wonder, how did I ever enjoy the original? Like, how often have any of us on the panel, once an expansion came out, said, you know what, I'm going to go to find the executable that lets me play the game before this expansion? Ah, crickets, exactly.
Yeah, and then there is discussion, hey, you know what, you left out Alpha Centauri. So if you're going to put BE in there, why didn't you put Alpha Centauri in there?
He claimed that Alpha Centauri would obviously win, which I think is a rather big reach.
I think the better argument from him would have been, and even then this is problematic, is, hey, there's no actual word civilization in the title. But then you could say, there was this thing called Civilization Call to Power. And then he put in the preface, I'm just talking about mainstream direct, none of the offshoots. And of course, someone said in the comments, how come there's no console mention here? Well, this is PC Gamer, so I think they're safe.
Yeah.
From excluding the console version, I don't...
Well, it makes me wonder if you put Revolution in there, would Revolutioner be of one worse game?
No, I don't think so.
No, Rev wouldn't have been a worse game.
I think it would have been solidly mediocre.
Yep.
Like Civ 2 or Civ 3.
Probably a little ahead of Civ 3 would be my guess, but not much.
Yeah, it's a concept of you messed up your poll.
Call in today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 441-228-8-7659. That's 441-228-8-POLY.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast, Revcast, and Turncast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
Thank you for joining us on Polycast episode number 236. I am the main team, and today I was joined by Dan Q.
Unique ability, Perseverance.
Makalua.
I will require more caffeine before you make me do math again.
Imagine.
subsisting on stuff.
And guest co-host, the Chris D.
I like math, just like I like trains.
It's not interesting unless we're actually able to make the Yo Mama jokes at the AI during diplomacy.
Yeah, because that would be amusing.
With Oceanic Wonders and Civilization Beyond Earth Rising Tide, constructing wonders is now worth your time.
But...
So, have fun editing all that, Dan.
I have fun editing everything, Magin. What are you talking about? Record date August 22nd, 2015. Civilization 4, 5, and Beyond Earth sound clips copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.